This is The Full Spectrum. The show provides a wide range of news and competing opinions. The commentaries, beliefs, and viewpoints expressed by segment hosts and guests do not necessarily represent those of WJSU-FM, Jackson State University, or its administrators. The content of this program is for informational and/or entertainment value only and not meant as an endorsement or recommendation in lieu of professional guidance on relevant topics.
It's the full spectrum. We got news.
Entertainment.
Interviews. And so much more. It's the full spectrum.
On today's show, the launch of the Why Medicaid Works campaign, and a new report says Americans are getting fatter. Welcome to The Full Spectrum for Wednesday, September 12th. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. The Mississippi Health Advocacy Program and the Mississippi Center for Justice together launched the Why Medicaid Works campaign today. The main goal of the effort is to educate people about a proposal that would require Medicaid enrollees in Mississippi to work at least 20 hours a week. Roy Mitchell is executive director of the Mississippi Health Advocacy Program.
We're here today to launch an initiative known as Why Medicaid Works. We want to inform the public on changes to the state's Medicaid policy. And these are dramatic changes. What the State Division of Medicaid has asked the federal government to do is allow them to impose a Medicaid work requirement on Medicaid recipients in the state. And Medicaid recipients are our most vulnerable population. This is a dramatic change in our Medicaid program, and we're concerned that the majority of Mississippians are unaware of this dramatic change in the policy.
Have you looked at any data from other states that do have work requirements? What is the impact on the Medicaid programs in those states?
The distinction between Mississippi and other states that have a Medicaid work requirement is that Mississippi, for reasons that are still unknown to us, did not expand the Medicaid program. The states that have implemented a work requirement have expanded their Medicaid program to include working adults and who have some sort of income. Here, it just doesn't make any sense here. If recipients here start working, they will automatically be kicked off the Medicaid rolls. Another concern of ours is the bureaucracy of all this, the red tape associated with it. Our neighboring state of Arkansas that has implemented a Medicaid work requirement has seen that they have been kicked off 5,000 people purely because of bureaucratic reasons, not because they actually did or did not meet the work requirement, and that's in the first few months of implementation. So we're seeing issues that we knew would happen. Aside from the equity arguments about is it right to do this to Medicaid recipients, there's also a concern about a new layer of bureaucracy for the state. And ultimately, this is going to cost Mississippians money. Anytime you do a new program like this, it's got to cost money to verify. It's got to cost money to put people in job programs. And a lot of layers of verification are involved in this. It should be of concern to our legislators because we're having a legislative budget office meeting just next week. I'd like to see how the state plans to fund this initiative.
I was going to ask you about that because we know that the budget itself is on iffy ground. It varies from year to year, but certainly revenues have been on the, if not on the short side, on the low side, and that may not change over the next few years. We don't know for sure. Are you concerned about this moving forward? And I would like you to factor in the other layers of this. You know, generally healthcare, even if you're working, it's becoming more expensive. So moving forward, talk to me about not only this aspect of it, but how it plays into the other things we know are affecting healthcare in the country.
Well, in terms of healthcare in general, and you know, Medicaid included, there are a lot of efforts to streamline processing. There's a lot of different ways to make Medicaid more efficient. This is not one of them. This is going to add another layer of bureaucracy to the program that's already overburdened with a lot of rules and regulations. To add this other layer on top of what we're already trying to do to streamline the program makes no practical sense whatsoever.
And what are you hearing from legislators? You say you're concerned about our budget, what's going on in here in Mississippi. Have you had any discussions, and are you hopeful that they may be receptive to changes, or are you gearing up for a fight?
We are confident that once Mississippians know the details of this, they will start to communicate with their legislators. It's always been said, if we didn't have the federal government looking over our shoulder all the time, we would have a more efficient program. Well, if this is any indication of what the state does when we devolve federal programs to the state, it's not a good idea to give the state free rein on the Medicaid program, because this program is inefficient.
I also got a chance today to talk with the executive director of the Mississippi State Conference, NAACP, Dr. Corey Wiggins, who also spoke at today's launch. Corey, talk to me a little more about what you were saying about the impact on minority communities.
Well, I mean, when you think about families across the state, particularly families of color, African American, Latino, Hispanic families, who rely upon Medicaid as a support system and helping them have access or supporting them getting access to health care, and enacting a work requirement Medicaid which limits their opportunity to have health insurance, particularly if they're in communities or places where there may be issues around finding work, there may be challenges, any number of challenges around income. It limits access to health care, and we're at a point in time where we should be supporting families in increasing opportunity and access to health care.
I asked Roy earlier about how he thought this would play out moving forward, because we know that the budget is questionable every year. Do you think moving forward that more needs to be put in place to make sure that we are not in this bind in terms of health care for the working poor or for people who are not working?
Well, I think if we're painting this in a budgetary conversation, one of the things we have to be honest and one of the things we have to realize is that really in increasing access to health care helps the budget. When you have more people who have health insurance and health care who can use that to pay into the system, it ultimately lowers and helps reduce the cost or lowers or slows the growth of costs in health insurance or health care. And so when we're talking about, like, how do we address issues around budgetary concerns, then this idea of work requirement, I wouldn't connect the two together, because what we need to be doing is making sure folks have health care, and it helps the overall system. But now the budgetary question is when you start to think about other decisions that's being made that puts us in a place where we don't have the resources to make those kinds of investments to make sure that Mississippians have health insurance and health care.
Right or wrong, and there's a big debate among people with different ideologies across the country about benefits in general, but one of the things you hear a lot is if they start working, then they lose their eligibility to get some of these benefits, but they're clearly not making enough money to take advantage of the services they would have been getting had they not been working. So how do you deal with that dilemma?
Well, I mean, I think that's a dilemma that this state and this country has to deal with. The fact that we got a number of folks who wake up each and every day and go to work, but still do not make enough money to meet their basic needs. And that's the issue when you look at wages, when you look at income in this state. And the question becomes, how do we support these families? Their value, their worth to our communities is great, and we have to be supportive of them. And so that's a broader question I think we have to address. But I can tell you what, ensuring that folks do not have health insurance is not the way to address their problem.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more on today's launch at the Capitol. Stick around.
Support of this program is made in part by
From sore throats and fevers to annual wellness visits and more specialized care, Merit Health Medical Group has you covered with more than 30 primary care and specialty practices across the Jackson and Vicksburg metropolitan areas. Merit Health Medical Group providers offer care with your schedule in mind. Walk-ins are welcome at all primary care practices. Same day or next day appointments are available at 844-MS-MERIT. That's 844-MS-MERIT, because there's merit in convenient care.
Jackson State University's College of Business strives to produce ethical and technologically advanced global leaders. The College of Business delivers its academic programs through four departments: accounting, economics, finance, and general business, entrepreneurship and small business management, and management and marketing. The college also offers two master's and one PhD program. For more information on the accredited College of Business, 601-979-2411. We're Jackson State University.
Welcome back to the Full Spectrum on Cool and Current WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. We've been talking about the Why Medicaid Works campaign, which launched today at the state capitol. I spoke with a couple of people you've already heard from, and now we're going to hear from Joan Alker, who is executive director of the Center for Children and Families at the Georgetown University Health Policy Institute. They worked with MHAP and MCJ to release a report about the harmful effect of work requirements to receive Medicaid.
So talk to me about the study.
Sure. So we looked at who would be impacted by Mississippi's proposed Medicaid changes, and what we found that it would be overwhelmingly mothers, particularly families living in rural areas and small towns, and disproportionately African American.
People who are trying to put this program into legislation would say that in the end it's going to help the budget for the state, it will save us money. That's always a complicated issue, because where you save in one area, you may end up having to spend more money in another area. So talk to me about what the impact you think would be of implementing this program on the budget.
So the state itself says thousands of parents would lose coverage. Probably some of their kids would as well. So you might see some short-term savings, but the reality is these families are not going away, and their healthcare needs aren't going away. So what will happen is they won't be able to access primary preventive care, things like prescription drugs to control their diabetes, their hypertension, and they'll show up in the emergency room. So this is a very short-sighted proposal. We know that it is much smarter to use your dollars up front to cover primary preventive care so folks don't get sicker and wind up in the emergency room. And we all pay for that.
Of course we care about what's going on here in Mississippi, but put what's going on here in context in terms of what's going on around the country, and especially if you could differentiate for me between those states which took the Medicaid match money and those that didn't.
Yes, great question. So far the Trump administration has approved four states to do work requirements. All of those states have taken the Medicaid dollars and have expanded their Medicaid programs. Mississippi could be the first in the country where the Trump administration might approve this kind of proposal in a state that has not taken those federal dollars. What that means is the only adults you have on your program that will be impacted are these very poor parents, mostly mothers.
The study was examining empirical evidence about these kinds of programs. Did you at all talk about best practices or have suggestions about alternative methods that could be used to try to contain these costs and deal with this issue?
So our study was looking at particularly this proposal, but more generally in the Medicaid budget. The reality is that Medicaid costs are actually going up pretty slowly. What's going up in our country is our healthcare costs. This is a system-wide problem. It is not a Medicaid problem. Prescription drugs is an area that I would mention where we have seen a lot of rapid costs, and we need much more aggressive action by this administration to contain those prescription drug costs. That would help Medicaid, and that would help all of us. One of the reasons this proposal is so flawed is that for these mothers, they are put in a catch-22 situation. If they were to comply with the new rules, they would earn over income, even though their income would be very low, and they couldn't get Medicaid. If they don't comply with the new rules, they would also lose their Medicaid. So this is a real catch-22. It makes no sense. And I'll just note, your neighbors in Arkansas are already implementing a similar proposal, and the only way folks can report is online. Well, that's a big problem in Arkansas, and I suspect that would be a big problem here in Mississippi. In Arkansas, it's clear folks don't know what's happening, and they're losing their coverage by the thousands simply because they're unaware of the new red tape and reporting requirements.
Where are we, do you think, in terms of containing health care costs? You brought this issue up. What could we be doing better, and should we be doing better so that we might not have this problem?
I mean, the reality is the population Mississippi is looking at here are the very poor parents and their children. They're not the cost drivers in your Medicaid program. Really, the aging of the population, Medicaid is the primary payer of long-term care. That's where we're going to see our health care costs really grow over the next decade. Unfortunately, the Trump administration is not doing anything about that issue. Instead, they're focusing all their energy, like the state of Mississippi, on this very poor families with children. They're not the ones driving the cost increases. So I think our government really needs to get ahead of this issue. We know the population is aging. We know more folks are going to need long-term care services, and we've got to figure out better ways to efficiently deliver those services. The question is about how many folks would lose coverage. So in Arkansas, this month, almost 5,000 are losing coverage. In Mississippi's proposal, the state's own numbers suggest 5,000 a year would lose coverage. Now, Arkansas has taken the Medicaid expansion, so they have far more people that are subject to this new policy. But Mississippi, over the course of the proposal, estimates about 20,000 parents would lose coverage.
Knowing what you know about what's going on in other states, and as you say, it's not a perfect comparison because some states are getting that Medicaid match money, does that number sound right to you, the estimate that 5,000 a year would lose coverage, or do you think it would be more?
I think it could be more, and I'll tell you what, it doesn't include any children in that estimate. So children are not, technically children are exempted, but we know when parents lose coverage, oftentimes their children lose coverage as well. Even though they're not supposed to, they will. We know that from a lot of research. So I suspect the number will be higher, and it will include children as well.
In other Mississippi news, a jury is deciding whether the district attorney in Mississippi's most populous county is guilty of stalking and robbery. Testimony in the trial of Hinds County District Attorney Robert Shuler Smith concluded today after Smith took the stand in his defense. Smith is charged in relation to a 2015 incident involving former girlfriend Christy Edwards. News outlets report witnesses say Smith found a man in a closet who was having an affair with Edwards. She says Smith threw her around and then took her gun. Smith contradicts those witnesses, saying he never pointed a gun at Edwards or the other man. Attorney General Jim Hood's office is prosecuting the case in neighboring Rankin County after Hinds County jurors acquitted Smith of hindering prosecution in 2017 following an earlier hung jury. We are going to take another break now. When we come back, a new report on obesity in America.
Are you interested in becoming a science or math teacher? If so, STEM Stars at Jackson State University is for you. For more information on JSU's STEM Stars program, 601-979-1247. That's 601-979-1247.
Support of this program is made in part by From sore throats and fevers to annual wellness visits and more specialized care, Merit Health Medical Group has you covered with more than 30 primary care and specialty practices across the Jackson and Vicksburg metropolitan areas. Merit Health Medical Group providers offer care with your schedule in mind. Walk-ins are welcome at all primary care practices. Same day or next day appointments are available at 844-MS-MERIT. That's 844-MS-MERIT, because there's merit in convenient care.
Welcome back to The Full Spectrum on Cool and Current WJSU. I'm your host, Dwayne Doty. The Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Foundation have released the 15th annual report, The State of Obesity, Better Policies for a Healthier America. I spoke this afternoon with John Auerbach, who is president and CEO of Trust for America's Health. John, tell me about this year's study.
This year, for the 15th year in a row, Trust for America's Health and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation analyzed the latest data about obesity in America. And unfortunately, what we found was that the rates for obesity are, if anything, getting worse. We found six states, for example, with statistically significant increases in their obesity rates. And very disturbingly, we didn't see a single state with improvement.
What were the six states?
Iowa, Massachusetts, Ohio, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, and South Carolina. So Mississippi wasn't among the states with the statistically significant increase this year. That said, the Mississippi rate is a very high rate.
Tell me what you infer from the fact that no states had a significant decrease in that rate.
We fear that this reflects the fact that even though we have paid a lot of attention to obesity as a nation over the last several years, and more Americans are aware of this issue, we just aren't doing enough to stem the tide. It suggests to us that we need to redouble our efforts, make sure that we have the right amount of resources devoted to this very serious health problem, and that we get not just one or two sectors, not just the health and public health sector involved, but we get everyone involved in the community, because there's a role for everyone in addressing this very serious problem.
I know my listeners have probably heard this before, but obesity levels are highest in Black and Latino communities. Talk to us about why that is.
Well, we believe that the elevated rates in the Black and the Latino communities relate in large part to income level. We know, for example, that people who are lower income are much more likely to live in communities where there are not nearby stores that sell fresh fruits and vegetables, for example, or are less likely to be in neighborhoods where there are well cared for parks and recreation facilities that are open to the members of the community. So if there isn't access to healthy, affordable food or to accessible and safe recreational facilities, people are not going to be able to do as much to control their weight.
And while you say that, and it makes sense, you also write in the study that obesity is a problem across income and social sectors.
It is. Obesity rates have increased throughout the nation, independent of social status and race. They've gone up for everyone, but they haven't gone up as much for some as for others. And so while every community has been affected by the increase in obesity rates, the lower income communities and the Black, Latino, American Indian communities have been more hard hit. I'd also add, what we have found from the research is that it also is true that the rural communities have had a greater increase in obesity than many of the urban communities or suburban communities, a somewhat surprising finding, but one which the research suggests is also associated with lack of access to healthy foods or safe and available places for exercise.
I found this interesting. You guys write that the obesity rate among children enrolled in the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for women, infants, and children, that rate went down between 2011 and 2014.
Yes, that's very encouraging news. What that suggests is that when families receive nutrition counseling, which is what comes along with the WIC program, as well as supplementary food that is healthy, which comes along with WIC, that will have a positive impact on their overall weight and health. And so we think that there are certain lessons from the WIC program that we can extend to school-age children and to adults, for that matter. Give people information, counseling, and support, and also give them assistance in terms of having access to those healthy foods. Those two things seem to be tickets to successful impact.
And could you remind me, is there a link between being obese as a child and being obese as an adult?
There is. The children that are obese are at much greater risk of being obese as adults. In part, that's because as children, we develop our eating habits and our exercise habits, and it's not easy to change those when people grow into adulthood. It certainly is possible, and there are many people who may have been overweight as a child that are not overweight as an adult, but you're at greater risk of being obese if you are obese as a child.
And it's interesting when you start talking about the cost, $149 billion annually in directly related healthcare spending and an additional $66 billion in lowered economic productivity. As you said earlier, we need more sectors involved in this, not just the healthcare sector. And you would think that would drive other sectors to try to do something to contain those costs.
You're right, Duane. I think those figures are important ones because they illustrate that this is something that affects everyone because you may not be the person who develops that obesity-related illness, but the costs associated with healthcare go up as a result of the increase in the prevalence of diabetes and heart disease and hypertension. And not only that, we have found from talking to people in the Department of Defense and looking at their records that our actual national safety can be affected by obesity because one in three of the applicants for military service are shown to be ineligible because of weight. So there are many broad consequences to the obesity epidemic that make it more important for all members of the public to think about what can we do? What can we do to help create those conditions in the communities that make it easier for the healthier behavior to occur?
Highlight some.
We are finding people are interested in changing their behaviors. They just run into these very serious obstacles, be they economic or geographic, and helping them to overcome that is necessary.
Highlight a couple of the main recommendations you guys came up with.
We would start by saying everyone has a role, and so we try to identify the different roles of different sectors. With regard to federal government, we highlight the importance of the federal government increasing funding for the CDC so it can provide obesity-related grants to Mississippi, to Jackson, and to states and cities around the country that give them the resources to begin to tackle this issue more seriously. We look at the the food manufacturers, and we would say to them, reduce the sugar content, the excess calories, but also agree to stop marketing unhealthy foods to children, which we see as a contributing factor to kids eating unhealthy foods. We'd look at the schools and say, at the schools, let's make sure that every school has healthy food available to children so a parent can rest easy when they send their child to school. The child will get a healthy meal. And make sure that physical education or recess occurs as part of the normal school day.
I guess that also adults do a little more physical activity as well.
That's absolutely right.
Well, John Auerbach with Trust for Americans Health, you've given us a lot of good advice today, and keep up the good work in terms of tracking how the obesity rates are going in the country.
Well, thank you so much for drawing attention to this issue.
All right, that's our show for today. Don't forget to catch Metro Morning Live with Rob J tomorrow at 7 and again at 10 on JSU TV, Comcast Channel 14. Up next, Latin Jazz with your host, Dale Morris. Have a great evening.